This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch us on TV at Free Speech TV and on our website. The Trump administration kicked its foreign policy off with a series of drone strikes on Yemen, the poorest nation in the Gulf Arab region. President Obama had begun U.S. involvement in that war. It seems as though there is substantially not enough difference between Democratic and Republican administrations on foreign policy as many would like. Whether it's under the rubric of humanitarian intervention or overt coveting for other nations and natural resources, U.S. foreign policy has been active, destructive, and formidable. Tracing the debates over American expansionism back to 1898 and the Spanish-American War is a new book by Stephen Kinzer, award-winning foreign correspondent, author of Overthrow, All the Shah's Men, and many other books. He served as Latin America correspondent for the Boston Globe and as the New York Times bureau chief in Nicaragua, Germany, and Turkey. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. He now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. Welcome to the program, Stephen Kinzer.
Great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, when we look back at the origins, of course, of the United States, it's hard to reconcile the anti-colonial origins of the United States, regardless of course, one's views on the genocide of Native Americans, but the anti-colonial roots of the United States with what came after 1898. So how do you explain in a nutshell what the drive was for, what was at the heart of the drive for American expansionism in 1898, given that soon before that, we saw the Philippines, which was one of the main targets of that war, declare its independence from Spain. This should have been something that Americans as a whole should have been celebrating, right? Not seeing as an opportunity.
You've just framed the great debate that broke out for the first time in 1898-99 and has continued really up to this day. So there have been many books about the Spanish-American War and how the U.S. took the Philippines and these other territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, etc. But I found in my research a new story that I didn't even know had ever happened. And all of my books really fall into that category. I'm looking for untold stories, great episodes in history that, for whatever reason, have fallen out of the textbooks and been turned into footnotes. So what I discovered was that when the United States made this epochal decision that we're not going to stop at the borders of North America, we're going to continue expanding overseas and build our empire beyond our homeland, the entire nation broke out into a huge debate. This was not something we did automatically. The entire nation was focused on this question. The Senate debated it for more than a month. Every major political and intellectual figure in America took sides. You had Theodore Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge and William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper publisher, on one side. On the other side, you have a great array ranging from Andrew Carnegie, the richest man in America, to Jane Addams, the social reformer, and Booker T. Washington, the African-American leader, Mark Twain, a whole series of figures who rose up to make the argument you've just made, which is the United States was created on the principle that all authority for government comes from the consent of the governed. Our Constitution begins, "We the people." Abraham Lincoln talked about government of, for, and by the people. So how can we then now go out and capture other countries and try to shape them according to our will and not allow them to follow their own path? Well, President McKinley had a great answer. He said, did we need their permission to carry out this great act for humanity? We had it in every aspiration of their hearts, in every hope of their souls. So what he was saying essentially is that some people in the world are able to rule themselves. Others are not at that stage yet. They're too primitive and they need our guidance. The subtext, of course, is that countries that are inhabited by and ruled by white people are sophisticated enough to govern themselves. All other countries need to be governed by others. So this was the excuse that we used to extend our military, strategic, political, and economic power over other countries. And it's still an argument we're hearing today.
Now, how long did those debates get stretched out? What was the sort of national dialogue at the time? I mean, on the side of American imperialism was the biggest newspaper man, William Randolph Hearst, who of course had huge influence over public opinion. Did he use that power?
Actually, looking back at the way Hearst used the power of the press is a little bit of a sobering reminder that the idea of fake news didn't just start this year or last year. It's something that William Randolph Hearst used intently to whip up American enthusiasm for involvement in war in Cuba. So he would send reporters to Cuba to write stories about how awful things were, and you did get a number of graphic stories about the ribs that are poking through the sagging skin of dying Cubans. People wrote stories of watching the victims of Spanish oppression literally die in front of their eyes. Only later did it turn out those reporters had never even been in Cuba. They were just inventing the stories of what they assumed must have happened. It's like assuming there must be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and the press jumps on it. Even greater example was the episode that actually propelled us to war in Cuba. That was the blowing up of our warship, the USS Maine, in Havana Harbor. The headline on the New York Journal banner across the front page was, "Sinking of the USS Maine was the work of an enemy." And on that front page, there's actually a diagram that shows how the Spanish blew up that ship. You see the waterline. Under the waterline, the mine is placed. And you see the cords leading to the onshore detonator that the Spanish used to blow up the ship. Only years later did it become clear there was no mine. There was no detonator. 70 years later, the Navy convened a board of inquiry and they found out it was all an accident caused by a spark inside the ship. But just like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in Vietnam, so many other episodes that so-called pulled us into war, whether it was in Syria or Iraq or other places, this one was fabricated. And it shows you what great power the press has in the debate over imperialism that set us out on this course. William Randolph Hearst was the megaphone. So Henry Cabot Lodge was kind of the Mephistopheles in Washington directing the whole campaign. Theodore Roosevelt was the front man, but without the press, the campaign would not have reached the American people. And I think it really is a matter for concern today, because our foreign policy is supported not just by a coalition of Republicans and Democrats, as you pointed out, and a coalition of liberals and conservatives and most of the think tanks in Washington, but the press is very much on board. So all the American war drums that are beating whatever country we're after today, these days it's Russia, is amplified by the press. This is not the role the press is supposed to play. The press is supposed to say, well, everybody in government is beating one drum. Maybe we should see if there's another way to look at the story. Maybe something else is happening. But we're not doing that. And I don't think the press is doing a much better job now than it did in 1898. The difference is we don't have enough figures protesting that with the eloquence that we did back in the period that my book covers.
So let's talk specifically about that eloquence. What role did figures like Mark Twain play? People, you know, like him who really enjoyed reputation for being a respected public intellectual. What role did they play, or were they able to play, in trying to shift the debate away from American expansionism?
Actually, my book writing projects are all journeys of discovery for me, too. So my greatest discovery in writing this book was simply that this debate happened. So I've recovered a historical episode that was huge at the time, but that's been pretty much forgotten. So that was my main discovery. But I also made some subsidiary discoveries, and one had to do with Mark Twain. So I've grown up with this image, and I think most Americans would say the same, that Mark Twain was a very lovable, old grandfatherly type who cracked funny jokes and who was beloved by everybody. Just a real nice sweetheart. But that's not true. I realize now that when it came to skewering American imperialism, Mark Twain was vicious. He was vituperative. He had a poisonous pen. He wrote that Theodore Roosevelt, for example, was clearly insane and by far the worst president we have ever had. Meanwhile, Roosevelt replied that he would like to skin Mark Twain alive.
Wow.
So I love discovering the real hard edge of Mark Twain. He proposed that the U.S. flag be changed so that the white flags be replaced with black and the stars should be replaced with skull and crossbone emblems to show what face we really show to the world. So discovering a little bit of the real Mark Twain behind the gentle image we've been taught was a real thrill for me as we went through this process of writing this book.
And so what hold did his and the arguments of Booker T. Washington and others of the anti-imperialists at the time have over the public? Was it the blowing up of the USS Maine that sort of tipped the debate over to the imperialist side and sort of swayed public opinion, or is that too simplistic?
I think the blowing up of the USS Maine did promote U.S. intervention in Cuba, but that didn't necessarily mean that we had to take the next step and subject Cuba to our will and take other faraway colonies that had nothing to do with the Cuban War, like the Philippines. So those were separated issues. What happened in the Philippines was that at the end of 1898, the United States signed a treaty with Spain in which Spain surrendered all of its territories in the Western Hemisphere. That was Cuba and Puerto Rico, plus Guam and the Philippines in the Pacific. Now, that treaty had to be ratified by the U.S. Senate. We had to ratify a treaty saying the Philippines is now going to belong to us. We had paid Spain $20 million for the Philippines. Andrew Carnegie offered to pay the U.S. Treasury $20 million to buy the Philippines for himself so he could give it independence. But at the end of 1898, this treaty was signed and the Senate had to debate it. During January and February of 1899, the U.S. Senate was involved in a 32-day debate, not just over the question of the Philippines, but over the much greater question, should the United States begin projecting its military and political and economic power around the world? We had senators rising up like George Frisbee Hoar of Massachusetts saying, you have no right at the cannon's mouth to impose on foreign peoples your constitution and your Declaration of Independence and your notions of freedom and what is right. Others replied that we had a duty and an obligation to go out and lift up these people and in the meantime find new markets and resources for ourselves. So as I was reading through this debate that shook the Senate, I had the feeling I might have been the first person in 50 years whoever looked at those debates. That's an episode that was a real turning point in American history. And the arguments that they make on both sides are exactly the arguments we make today. There's nothing new. This debate back in the beginning of 1899 in the U.S. Senate truly is, in the history of American foreign policy, the mother of all debates. Every single point on both sides was made then, except that the people were much more articulate then. One of the thrills of reading these debates is to see how sophisticated the senators were on both sides. They're referring back to ancient history and quoting Pliny the Elder and talking about the Catiline conspiracy and debating what was responsible for the fall of Rome. These are discussions you couldn't imagine being held in the U.S. Senate today. But here you had probably a debate that's only been matched once in American history. Only when the U.S. was founded and we had the original founding debates in Philadelphia did so many brilliant Americans come together to debate a question so fraught with meaning for all mankind.
So would you say that those debates in 1898 set the consensus up for this idea of American exceptionalism on a global stage, one that was echoed just as eloquently by a Barack Obama as it has been by a George W. Bush? And that is why these days the question of whether the U.S. should even be an imperialist power is just not up for serious debate.
It's true. Our foreign policy establishment and our fundamental foundations of foreign policy tell us that we are the indispensable nation, that we need to project power everywhere in the world to maintain stability, and that projecting power usually should be done by coercive force. One of the things I learned from writing this book is that this not only is a very old debate, but that both sides are still very strong. So the U.S. Senate approved that Treaty of Paris, by which the United States became an overseas empire, by one vote more than the required two-thirds majority. Then the question was submitted to the Supreme Court. Is it constitutional to rule other peoples without giving them the rights that are guaranteed to American citizens? And the Supreme Court ruled that it was, that the Constitution does not follow the flag. But they ruled that by one vote. It was a 5-4 vote. So, yes, the imperialists won then, and they've won most of the battles since then. But the anti-imperialist side, or the anti-interventionist side, has also had substantial victories and has always been an important force. Had it not been for the anti-imperialists around 1898, 99, 1900, we might have begun annexing other countries. We might have annexed parts of Mexico, parts of Africa, parts of China, Guatemala, Nicaragua. But they were the ones who pointed out that these things don't end well. And as war in the Philippines began going badly, we pulled back. So I think the first debate, the one I write about in my book, shows something that you still see today. And that is that the American psyche is divided on this great question. Should we intervene abroad or should we not? I think we answer yes to both. Yes, we need to intervene to help other people and to protect ourselves from dangers that might come to our shores and to liberate the oppressed and to promote our interests. No, interventions only multiply our enemies and bring pain to the target countries and weaken our own interests. We still have not resolved this. And although logic tells you have to choose one side in this argument because they're opposites, actually, we don't. Forced to choose between two irreconcilable alternatives, we choose both. We are imperialists because we want to impose our will on others because we feel we have so much to give them. On the other hand, we don't want to bother other people and take away their right to decide. So both of these instincts coexist within us. And I think depending on circumstances, they come out in different proportions. There are moments when we get very excited about intervening in foreign countries and we bomb and we invade or we use other forms of pressure. Then the blowback starts, begin to realize that this actually doesn't work out the way we hope, and we go into a period where we're less eager to do that. But as I said, I'm not sure it's really just a pendulum swing. I think we're conflicted as a nation about whether to do this. And the back and forth you're hearing from Trump, depending on what day he's talking or who he's tweeting to, reflects this. One day, we're going to stop fighting regime change wars and build up our country. The next day, we're going to punish any country that stands up to us. So which is it? You can't have both of these views, but not only does Trump have them both, so do most Americans. And I think that's the frustrating dichotomy that shapes our conflicted approach to the world.
Finally, Stephen Kinzer, do you see American expansionism, as much as it has been expansionist, as central to the political and economic power of this nation? In other words, would this be the world superpower without the extent of imperialism that the U.S. is engaged in?
this was one of the big issues that was debated in that first great debate that I write about in my book back in 1899. I spent a lot of time going through old newspapers and old magazines to understand the tenor of the time. And one theme that is continually referred to is what was then called glut. We have too much overproduction. So the American manufacturers and the American farmers had mastered the techniques of mass production so fully that we were producing more goods and growing more crops than we could consume. And this was causing trouble inside the United States. There was labor unrest. We had riots. We had Pinkertons shooting down strikers. We needed an outlet for our excess production and the China market and all these other fantastic options that seemed available to us were the only way we could think of doing that. So in a sense, we exported our social problems to other countries in exchange for the markets and resources that we could bring back. Now, what about today and the economic importance of U.S. Intervention? I would argue that in many cases, our military and coercive intervention ultimately weakens our economy, partly because it drains resources away from the United States. Those are resources that could be used to build up our country economically in a different way. Now, it goes back in a certain sense all the way back to 1630 when John Winthrop, the Puritan leader, made that famous speech when he said, we shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all people are upon us. So what did he mean? Did he mean we should go out into a sinful world and redeem it and fix it and make it better? Or did he mean the opposite? We should build our own virtuous society at home and hope that others will use it as a model. So I believe that our economic strength now in the long run is based on our ability to cooperate with other countries and not to pull ourselves away from other countries. Intervention creates enemies. It pushes people away from us. And that's an economic as well as a political phenomenon. So our great challenge as a nation is to be able to recognize the sorrows of empire, the blowback, the trouble that these interventions ultimately wind up causing. And just looking at Iraq and Libya, we can see some recent examples of this. The point I'm trying to make in my book is that those who are resisting the push towards interventionism and militarism on the part of the United States and the rest of the world did not invent this resistance. The cause of non-intervention and respecting other countries has a rich tradition in this country. It goes back more than 100 years and includes some of our most revered figures. That is the forgotten history that I'm trying to bring back in this book.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, I thank you so much for the work that you've done in uncovering these untold stories. I know that you're going to be on book tour in the next few months. We'll post details about that on our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
That was great. Thank you.
Stephen Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent. He is currently the senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown Universities. We've been talking about his new book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.